Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the 1981 murder of Olivia Christian. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, like and leave a 5-star review. You also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just like my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we were discussing the murder of Olivia Christian, whose body was found inside of her Newport, Virginia apartment on September 4th, 1981. She had been savagely beaten and strangled to death, and as the coroner discovered during his autopsy of Olivia, there was no sexual assault as she had died a virgin. The officers who were investigating Olivia's murder wasted no time going through their list of suspects, clearing Olivia's boyfriend, John Kelly, when after speaking to his boss, they learned that Kelly had been at his desk at 7:30 that morning. One individual who got caught up in all of this was a man by the name of Michael Alston. If you'll recall from the last episode, I mentioned an African-American man who was said to frequent the apartment complex, possibly be a peeping Tom, and also to have had relations with at least one woman who lived there. Michael's name kept coming up over and over again as the detectives interviewed people living inside the apartment complex, and because of this, naturally, they had to go and run this lead down, which they did the following day. This was on September 5th of 1981, and it was found that he lived in a small house about a quarter of a mile away from the apartments. In his driveway, they saw a Chrysler sedan, which had been produced in the mid-1970s. It was a blue four-door. However, when they knocked on the door, a clean-shaven man answered. If you'll recall, their biggest witness claimed to have seen a man with a mustache. And the information that they had on Alston was that he had a full beard. When they pressed him on this, Alston readily admitted to having shaved, stating that the previous day had been his birthday, and he decided to change things up a little bit. Obviously, the officers found this suspicious. More suspicious was the fact that Alston stated that at the time the murder had taken place, he was at home in bed, having gone out with some of his friends the previous night and tied one on. He also stated that while he had seen Olivia, he wasn't really familiar with her, other than the fact that she was the only white woman who lived inside of the complex. When Alliston's wife returned home, she too was questioned, and she confirmed her husband's alibi, stating that he had not gone to work on Friday because he had gone out drinking on Thursday night and had come home very early in the morning, somewhere around 3 a.m., and had been sleeping it off after that point. when the officers asked his wife why he had shaved, she stated, similar to what Michael had said, that it probably was because it had been his birthday. While the entire scenario seemed to be strange, the officers noted that there was no visible injuries either to Alliston's face or his arms, and while they were able to get Alliston's consent to take a picture of him to show to potential witnesses as well as to search his home and his car, they left his house realizing that there was almost certainly very little to tie Michael Alliston to this crime. That does not mean, however, that others would not tie Alliston to this crime. Being such a small community and this murder having been so high profile, others began talking about the fact that Alliston had been questioned by police, and rumors started going around that he was their prime suspect, as well as the possibility that he may, in fact, have committed the crime. Also around this period of time, investigators brought in a tracking dog, which the previous year had been used to solve two cases. The dog's owner was a man by the name of John Preston. The dog was known as Harass 2. This dog had a fairly good reputation, as it had solved the murders of a Radford University student by the name of Gina Renee Hall. The dog ends up tracking the scent of the individual who was suspected in that particular crime all the way to the main suspect's front door. And this individual ends up getting convicted of Hall's murder. The previous month, the dog had also helped solve a murder in Hampton, that of a 75-year-old man by the name of James Welch. Man had been found dead inside of his home. The man's wallet had been found empty in the backyard. The dog scenting on the man's wallet had led investigators to two sets of bloody palm prints on the back fence before proceeding to a house located two blocks away where an 18-year-old by the name of Tyrone Duffy lived. Duffy's handprints ended up matching those found on the back fence, and Duffy ends up being convicted for this crime. The dog and its handler were brought to Olivia's bedroom, and the dog immediately began following a scent trail, going out behind the apartment complex, through a stretch of woods, and then into a backyard where a barbecue was taking place. Obviously, the officers were intrigued by this, as the dog ends up going to a pair of tennis shoes that were sitting beside a dumpster. Obviously, the officers are now thinking that they may have found an area where their suspect has been. They talk with the homeowner, who gives consent for them to search the house. The dog immediately goes into the house. The handler states to the investigators that the dog is indicating that the person who had handled the alarm clock inside of Olivia's bedroom had been inside of this home. The officers learn that these shoes belong to an African-American man by the name of Ben Reeves, who was a house painter. And they learn that on the morning of the murders, he had been in and out of his home that he shared with his girlfriend a number of times, giving a timeline of events that he had woken up on the morning of September 4th at 6 a.m. went to a small market near his house and bought a black coffee, returning within roughly half an hour. He remained at the house until roughly 8:15 when he went out to purchase a coffee for his girlfriend, and he remained there until roughly 9 a.m., at which point he went to an auto parts store, which was located roughly a quarter of a mile from the Ivy Home Apartments. And after leaving this auto parts store, he had driven over to the house that the officers were now at. Reeves also stated that he had not walked over to this individual's house, but he had in fact driven there. And the officers were fairly quickly able to ascertain that he did in fact own a pickup truck and had driven it the day of the murders. Shifting a hair, officers have all of this information coming in. The family decides to put up a $2,500 reward in conjunction with a number of other organizations, which leads to a massive influx of tips about Olivia's murder. However, officers are still focusing on Michael Alston, who, if you'll recall, we spoke about just a few brief minutes ago. Over at the Ivy Home Apartments, people were really starting to talk about Alston, so much so that the only eyewitness to seeing anyone go inside of Olivia's apartment, that being Anita Purcell, her mother starts calling around the complex to find out more about Michael. One individual tells her that, well, he always thought Michael was a little odd. He didn't think he was crazy enough to have committed murder. Anita's mother is able to arrange with one of Alston's friends to have Alston come over to the apartment complex under the auspices of having a beer. What Mrs. Purcell is really doing is trying to give her daughter an opportunity to get a look at Michael Alston. When Michael does come over to the apartments, Anita and her mother go over to this individual's apartment, and Anita tells her mother that Michael Alston is not the man that she saw on the morning of the murders going into the building where Olivia Christian lived. Not long after this, the police arrive at the Purcell's apartment to talk with Anita. Officers again question her about the car that she saw before showing her the picture that they had taken of Michael Alston. And Anita again says that while he's somewhat similar in appearance to the man, Michael Alston is not in fact the murderer, stating, quote, "I'll never forget those eyes. They were the eyes of a monster. His eyes are different from Michael's." Officers pressed her further, informing her that he may have had a beard at the time. Anita refuses to budge, however. Also on that Sunday, officers got a lead on the possible Caucasian man that the maintenance worker had seen the day before Olivia's murder. If you'll recall, this was the individual who was sitting outside of Olivia's apartment when a woman who lived in the apartments contacted the police and told them that she had met with a man on Thursday who worked for an awning installation company based out of Norfolk. However, when officers checked on this man, they found that he did not, in fact, match the description of the individual who had been seen. On Labor Day, officers got another tip when they revisited the house that the dog had led them to from Olivia's apartment. They learned that an individual by the name of Crazy John Walter Parker, who was said to be mentally handicapped often used the trail and was in fact known to have fits of violent anger. Officers end up making contact with this man who is indeed handicapped, and they note right away that he sings to himself quite often. When asked of his whereabouts on the morning of Olivia's murder, he states that he had been at his house until 8 a.m. when his mother fixed him breakfast, and after that he had walked around and visited with friends. When officers shifted tactics during their interview of John and began pressing him that, you know, maybe he had seen Olivia and had desired to have a sexual encounter with her, John responded with, quote, "If I wanted sex, I would just buy it." John Parker is quickly written off as a suspect. Officers continue to be inundated with a slew of information as the week progresses. One of Olivia's friends states that she had told them at one point that a crisis hotline she volunteered for oftentimes had callers making threats to the individuals answering the phones, and that one particular individual who had called him had greatly disturbed Olivia. However, officers were unable to find any verification that this particular phone call came in. And although they're getting many, many leads, some of them that they are able to track down, officers are beginning to feel frustrated over the fact that they're not making any headway with this case. Also feeling frustrated during this period of time is the young eyewitness Anita, who later stated that she kept feeling that if only she had acted when she saw the suspicious-looking man driving into the parking lot, Olivia Christian's life may have been saved. However, it's understandable that she would not. She simply saw a vehicle drive into the parking lot, and there was no way of knowing what this individual's intentions actually were. By the end of the second week in September, officers have really dug deeply into Olivia's life, questioning sales representatives that she had met with during the summer to try and purchase things for the school, ex-boyfriends, also looking into the apartment across the way from Olivia's, where it was learned that three people had come and gone during the period of time when it is believed that Olivia Christian had been murdered, which is that very crucial window between 6:30 and 8 o'clock in the morning. When the officers questioned the trio again, they were unable to find any cracks in the stories that the people had initially told. On the morning of September 9th, which is a Wednesday, detectives are contacted by one of Olivia's neighbors. This individual was over in apartment B1, which is basically within the same building, but the next corridor over from hers. And when the officers went to speak with this individual, he stated that friends of his who had been visiting from out of state on the day of the murder had information that they wanted to share with the officers, but they were reluctant to come forward. What ends up coming out of all of this is that these two individuals told the occupant of the apartment that Michael Alston had come to his apartment on the morning of September 4th and had, quote, been very nervous. The occupant of the apartment further went on to state that he had seen Alston in the days since Olivia's murder and that the man seemed stranger than normal, although he did state that he had always considered Michael Alston to be, quote, kind of crazy and unstable emotionally. Now, with this information, officers begin piecing together a theory that Alston, who was said to be a peeping Tom and was often seen around the apartment complex, had been there on the day of Olivia's murder, that he had seen her go out and walk her cat, gone into the corridor leading into her apartment, seen the door open, and decided to go inside to see what valuables he could steal. And while he was in the process of looting her apartment, Olivia had returned home and surprised him, which in turn led to Alston attacking and murdering her. Alston ends up getting picked up by the police and brought down to the precinct, where he is read his Miranda rights, and an intense interrogation begins. And despite the pressure being put on him by the detective, Michael Alston refuses to crack, stating again and again that he had been at home asleep until 10 or 11 that morning, and that his wife had given him an alibi, further stating that he had never been inside of Olivia's apartment, and other than seeing her here and there, had had no real interactions with her, and that he was not interested in her in a sexual fashion and had no reason to go into her apartment. As the officers are interrogating Alston, his wife is interrogated again, and again she refuses to implicate her husband in the murder, stating that he was at home asleep on the morning of September 4th, and then going on to further state that Alston's odd behavior can be written off due to terrible experiences he had had over in Vietnam, that Alston had suffered from PTSD, or as what was known back then, shell shock. On Thursday evening, a woman arrives at the Hampton Police Department, where she begins recounting a story that intrigued officers greatly. She states that on September 3rd, she had been over near the apartments and had gone to the 7-Eleven, and that a large Chrysler had pulled up beside her vehicle. She had gone into the store, and when she came out, the driver of the vehicle was standing beside her car, and he began talking to her, informing her that she had a bald tire that she should get fixed. He then proceeds to pull out what this woman described as the largest wad of cash she had ever seen, and asking her if she needs money and would like to earn some money. When this woman informs the man that she might be interested, he goes on to tell her that he wants to pay her for sex. Officers then learn that this woman works at a club in the Hampton Mall, and that the other women who work at this cocktail lounge are known to prostitute themselves to the clientele of this club, and that she herself has done this on a number of occasions. The woman then goes on to state that the man followed her to an apartment, attempted to kiss her. She would not allow it. He had then put on leather gloves with holes on the knuckles and asked if he could tie her up. She declined this particular offer, after which they had consensual but rough sex. The woman told police that the man pulled her hair and hurt her a little bit, but that at the end of their encounter, the man seemed to get out of breath, and she feared he might have a heart attack, that the man had fallen asleep in her apartment and left the next morning at 6:30 a.m. However, the description of the man was at odds with the description of the man that Anita had seen. This particular woman who lived in the same apartment complex as Olivia and Anita stated that the man was around 40 years old, 6 foot tall, white, clean shaven, with a fat face and droopy eyes, short brown hair combed forward, and that he was wearing blue jeans and a Western style shirt, that he wore a large horseshoe shaped diamond ring. When shown a composite sketch drawn up of the white man the maintenance worker stated he had seen in the parking lot on Thursday, this woman stated that it in no way matched the man that she had had sex with in her apartment that Thursday night. Obviously, residents of the apartment become aware of this, and as the officers later noted, the introduction of this mysterious white man in a large Chrysler with a lot of money sowed confusion within the apartment complex. It's easy to see how this type of thing can take place. There's a reward on the line, and while it's not a great deal of money, $2,500, many of the individuals living in this area are barely making ends meet, scraping by. Some of them are on welfare, public assistance, that type of thing. And although they may mean well, they're giving this information in the hopes that they'll be able to collect on that reward. A case in point is Anita's mother, who repeatedly tells her daughter that they could really use that $2,500, and are you sure that Michael Alston is not the man that you saw? And while Anita agrees with her mother that they could use the money, she steadfastly refuses to point the finger at Michael Alston as the man responsible, as she knows in her heart that he is not the individual she saw going into the corridor leading into Olivia's apartment. This type of thing is extremely common in these types of cases. Another good example of this type of behavior is the Atlanta child murders, which I covered in depth a couple of years ago in a six-part series, and which a number of people have asked me to revisit. It was actually the first deep dive series that I did on the Deathcast. During the period that the murders are known to have taken place, a number of people contacted the police wanting to provide information on an individual they believe may have been responsible for the crimes, asking if there was a reward being offered. And the reasoning was the same as it is here. These individuals, regardless of their skin color, they're not in the middle class or upper 1%. They're average working men and women, and they see an opportunity to make money and possibly help the police, they're going to take it, although the helping of the police is secondary to the opportunity of making, you know, a decent little amount of money. Come forward and offer this information to the police in an effort to try and collect on that money. However, anyone who knows how these types of things work, in order to collect on a reward, you actually have to give information to the police that leads to a conviction. The reward that was offered by Roman Polanski's friends in the murder of Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, etc., was split between the two women who Susan Atkins spoke to while she was incarcerated on other charges, and it was that information and their testimony at trial which led to the conviction of Charles Manson and his followers. Because of all of this, and a number of other external factors, such as the fact that they were receiving pressure from above, officers decided to pull Michael Alliston in for a polygraph examination. I'm going to read a transcript of the questions that Michael Alliston was asked. Is your name Michael Alliston? Yes. Are you 36 years old? Yes. Do you reside at 16 Somerset Drive? Yes. Have you ever lied? Yes. Have you ever committed a crime? Yes. On Friday morning, were you at Ivy Home Apartments? No. On Friday morning, did you fight with a white female at Ivy Home Apartments? No. On Friday morning, did you beat a white female over the head at Ivy Home Apartments? No. Did you strangle the victim with a vacuum cord? No. Did you strangle the victim with an ironing cord? No. Did you strangle the victim with a clock radio cord? No. Did you strangle the victim with a curler cord? No. Did you strangle the victim with a buffer cord? No. We have discussed in great depth my opinion on polygraph examinations. They are bunk science. Movies and television shows like to play them up to be this great be-all, end-all that can eliminate suspects from a police investigation. The reality is, though, that they are the most fallible of all tools at law enforcement's disposal. There is no way to get 100% accuracy with them, as every individual is different and reacts differently to telling both the truth and to lying. And the way a polygraph examination works really is it measures your pulse. When you're lying, you know, it will indicate that your pulse is going up, showing deception. And because of all of this, it is not admissible in court anywhere, because it's just not possible to tell whether or not someone is telling you the truth or not the truth in this manner. Alliston is given the results of his polygraph examination, and he's informed that he has failed this test. At which point, he is again read his Miranda rights and questioned much more in depth, in a much more heavy-handed fashion. To his credit, though, Michael Alliston refuses to budge, insisting to the police over and over again that he had been at home on the morning of the 4th, sleeping off the previous night's activities, that he had never been in Olivia Christian's home, and that he did not murder her. The police take a different view, however, and officers are pulled off of the case as the chain of command believes at this point that they have their man, and that it's only a matter of time before Michael Alliston is arrested for Olivia Christian's murder. Problem with that is that there is no evidence tying Michael Alliston to this crime. By the time that Michael Alliston is given this lie detector tests, officers have received back the print cards for every fingerprint found inside of Olivia Christian's home. And other than a partial palm print and a partial fingerprint, every fingerprint inside of her house is able to be accounted for. These partial prints neither implicate nor exclude Michael Alliston. And really, the only thing that they have to go on pinning this crime on Alliston is a bunch of individuals living inside of this apartment complex, many of whom are trying to get this $2,500 reward. However, their main eyewitness continues to steadfastly refuse to implicate Michael Alliston as the individual she saw driving into the apartment complex, going into the hallway outside of Olivia's apartment, and then leaving a short time later. Further complicating matters in this case is the fact that the detective that was left on the case decided to contact a hypnotist in order to try and elicit further information from witnesses that might be locked within their subconscious. Now, the reason I say this further complicates things is, as with polygraph tests, hypnosis is considered to be a pseudoscience. It's not reliable. Some people are more susceptible to being hypnotized than others. And as any good defense attorney will point out, an individual who is under hypnosis is open to suggestions from the individual conducting the hypnosis session. Meaning that if an individual is placed under hypnosis and an unscrupulous officer happens to be present and wanted information about a particular suspect implanted inside the psyche of the individual who is under hypnosis, that possibility does exist. However, there really have been no conclusive studies to prove whether or not this is in fact a method that actually works. In this case, the officers were trying to develop Michael Alliston as a suspect in the crime. If you've listened to this show for any considerable period of time, you'll know that most cases are built on circumstantial evidence. Things such as people placing the suspect with the murder victim around the time that the crime took place, people having seen that individual in the general area where a crime took place, or in the case of a serial killer, the serial killer being able to be placed into that area via things such as credit card receipts, surveillance footage, things of that nature, a vehicle known to have belonged to the suspect or that a suspect had access to being seen in the general vicinity where a crime took place. That is really how a majority of cases are solved and are brought to trial and convictions are gotten. However, oftentimes, especially in this day and age now, they are able to present much more forensic evidence. What is forensic evidence? Forensic evidence is things that link the killer biologically to a crime to the exclusion of all others. That can be saliva or blood samples, hair, skin. In the case of the Atlanta child murders, Wayne Williams was linked to those crimes via fiber evidence, which, while suspect, is still admissible in most courtrooms today as the science has gotten much stronger. But not only do they want to find this forensic evidence from the killer on the victim or in the vicinity of the crime scene, they also want to find forensic evidence from the victim in the presence of their suspect. That could be on their clothing, in their house, any other place that the suspect may have gone to after encountering this victim. That is what investigators are looking for. In the case of Michael Alliston, however, he has a strong alibi from both himself and his wife. He has nothing really linking him to the crime other than the fact that he's known around the apartment complex and people think he is weird. And the only individuals who are implicating him in this crime are those who are seeking to get the reward money. The best eyewitness that the prosecution has at this point does not see Michael Alliston as the individual that she saw on the morning of September 4th. Why do I bring this all up? Anita ends up being hypnotized by a hypnotist that the police force has brought in with her mother's consent. Now, under hypnosis, Anita recounts what she has already told the police on multiple occasions, that her mother had just left for work. She's in the kitchen making pancakes for her siblings when she sees a four-door, faded aqua green car drive into the parking lot. She states that the roof of the car is a lighter aqua green than the rest of the vehicle, and that it was an older model, although she can't tell what kind of vehicle it is. Anita then states that she cannot see the license plate at this point, but there is an inspection sticker in the windshield that is white, black writing on it. And that the car goes down to the far end of the parking lot and turns around before backing into a parking space. She can see now that a man is sitting inside of the car, and it is a black man. He's just sitting there looking out. At which point, he gets out of the vehicle and walks towards Olivia Christian's building. I'm going to quote here from the actual transcript of Anita's hypnosis session. I can see his face. He has a mustache and he's got a dark blue ball cap on. It's just a plain dark blue ball cap. Okay, now he's in front of Miss Olivia's apartment building and he's looking in her window from the sidewalk while he's walking. And now he's past her building and he's turning around, hands on his hips, and walking back. He's looking into her windows as he's walking, and he walked past her building and then turned around and walked back again. Now he's going up to her window, he's on the grass, and he's behind the bush, real close to the window, looking in. He doesn't think anybody can see him, but I can. He's looking inside the window, up close. You're doing well, Anita. Keep telling me what you see. Now he's walking to the front door of her building, the outside door. He's opening it and leaning inside. He's holding it open behind him with his foot and leaning in with his ear to her door. And then the door just shut behind him and he disappeared. I can't see him anymore. Anita, can you see Olivia? No, and I'm thinking to myself, should I call the police? Can you see the man's car? Yeah, his car is still parked down at the end of the parking lot. Can you see the license plate number? No. That's okay, Anita. What do you see now? I go back to the stove to check the pancakes, and I keep going back to the window between flips, and I don't see the man or Miss Olivia. But his car is still in the same place. Then I go back to the window, and I see his car starting to leave. Now he's driving right by my window, and he's slowing down because there's a sewer drain that's like a big pothole. Now he's looking right at me. I can see him. I can see him. I can see them eyes. At this point, the hypnotist informs Anita that a police sketch artist is present with them, and that she is going to draw the details of the individual that Anita saw from her mind to create a sketch. On September 21st, the tracking dog is brought back from Pennsylvania. This time, after scenting on the alarm clock, it leads detectives to Michael Alliston's home, which further sharpens their resolve that Alliston is in fact the man that they are looking for. However, to the district attorney's credit, when detectives met with him, he refused to move forward, stating that they did not have enough evidence, circumstantial or otherwise, to bring a case against Michael Alliston. Because of this, the composite sketch that Anita made while she was under hypnosis ends up being released to the press on September 25th. From this sketch, they learn that the man who had previously worked as the maintenance man at the Ivy Home Apartments matched the picture that was in the paper, and that Olivia Christian had in fact put in numerous complaints about the way the man maintained the property of the apartment buildings. Although this individual ends up having a verifiable alibi. And things continue like this constantly. Police will get a tip about an individual who is similar in appearance to this composite sketch. They'll look into them, find that they have some ties to the Ivy Home Apartments. They'll run it down, only to be stymied when the individual is either found to already have been incarcerated or to have an alibi that holds up when put under a microscope. As they wind their way through October, the Hampton Police Department is no closer to solving Olivia Christian's murder. They have a number of suspects, the most prominent of which is Michael Alliston. They also have the white man that the maintenance worker at the apartment complex said they had seen. The officers begin to suspect that the story the maintenance worker told was not true and do a background check on the man, only to discover that he has two criminal convictions, one from a few years prior for passing bad checks, one from the previous year for larceny, which he had received a felony conviction and a 60-day suspended sentence. This prompts the officers to bring the maintenance man in to have a polygraph examination. And they learn from this polygraph that the man is lying when he says that he saw someone outside Olivia's apartment the day before her murder. However, he passes the questions concerning having murdered Olivia. When pressed by the officers and presented with the results of his polygraph examination, and told that he is more likely than not going to be facing charges for filing a false police report unless he comes clean, the man breaks down and admits that he made the entire thing up. When officers ask him why he has done so, the man states he feared that the officers, who are predominantly white, were going to railroad somebody living inside the Ivy Home Apartments for Olivia Christian's murder. We are going to end the episode at this point. We are now into October 1981, and while officers have one suspect, their main witness refuses to be pressured into naming the man as the person she saw. going into the hallway of Olivia Christian's apartment building. And they are no closer to solving the crime. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Until next time, stay morbid!